The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Villarreal win the Europa League, their first ever trophy after a penalty shootout that went on forever. David De Gea can't save them and can't score them either. Bad luck, or did Solskjaer get it wrong? Did he forget he had any substitutes? Is second and a European final a good or a bad season? Also, Southgate names a provisional squad with every footballer he can remember. Who will be the unlucky seven? Manager news, Conte and Zidane are off. Would have been more useful for them to do that before the Europod, to be honest. Apparently, Pochettino is talking to Spurs. There's a Champions League final and the playoff finals to look forward to. Your questions, more wedding invites, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Ben Fisher, welcome.
Hi, Max.
You got something good for us later?
Up my sleeve.
Oh, yes, how exciting. Anne-Marie Batson, nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, Max.
Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hi, Max.
And for part one, live from Gdansk, Archie Rintutt, who was working at the game yesterday. Hello, mate.
Dzień dobry.
Before we analyse United, what a great story for Villarreal, their first ever trophy and their first ever cup final. Archie, you were there with their fans. How was it?
Oh, you could tell through the day just how much they were enjoying it. The flares that they were letting off in the city centre, the noise that they were making. I mean, yellow is generally, I think, a colour which is more visible than the Manchester United ones, shall we say. You're going to notice it more, albeit I think that Manchester United's colours were more Stone Island in the city centre. But yeah, amazing story. And you look at the stories within it, the fact that Unai Emery had the time that he did in London, and to be honest, in the end in Paris, and comes out with that. I spoke to him after the game and I said to him, like, I was trying to, you know, end it on a funny note, and it was just like, so Etienne Capoue's told me that they're going to probably fill the trophy with beer. He'd rather fill it with rum, albeit he said they'd all die. You know, what's your routine in that? And he went off and didn't answer the question, and instead answered his own question, where he proceeded to point out that Arsenal and Tottenham will not be in the Champions League next season. Which I thought was, a little bit of needle, but why not, Unai? You've deserved it.
A UEFA Cup full of rum. I mean, that's a lot. Hard to pour as well, I think, out of that. I think you just have to drink it straight. That's why
Capoue in the end was like, you know what, beer's best for the team. So, and that is the Villarreal mentality summed up.
Barry, that penalty shootout, it went on forever, didn't it?
Yeah, well, it didn't go on forever. It was possibly the shootout of the highest quality I've ever seen. I mean, the penalty, even the guys who didn't want to take penalties, weren't in the five, struck brilliant penalties, and the goalkeepers didn't get much of a look in.
I think only Luke Shaw's was the one where you think, I could have saved that one. But apart from that, and Anne-Marie, there is an issue with David De Gea and saving penalties. Ben Littleton, who's a sort of penalty expert, has made his life on penalties and written books about penalties, saying, look, De Gea's record, this is during the extra time, does not make pleasant reading. His last penalty save was in 2016 against Romelu Lukaku. Since then, he's conceded 25 in a row. It's now 35 in a row. Or is it 36 in a row now? Time for Ole to make a late sub. And at Sporting Intel, Nick Harris, our mate, saying Dean Henderson in the same period has saved 8 penalties and conceded only 9. I mean, managers are judged on those huge decisions. I think it'd be very difficult to change your goalkeeper in the last minute. Van Gaal's done it before in a World Cup. Do you think he should have done that?
I was a bit surprised that Dean Henderson actually didn't start for the game. And I don't know if anybody else noticed, but when David De Gea walked up to take the penalty, he just didn't look confident at all. And then his obviously he couldn't react after when the penalty was saved, but he just didn't look confident. It wasn't a confident penalty. He's not a penalty taker, I know. I was just surprised because Dean Henderson's had a stellar season. I was just a little bit surprised that he wasn't between the sticks.
Sean Ingold was tweeting this morning saying, like, how much did Bruno Fernandes letting Villarreal go first in the shootout affect things? He got an email from the LSE professor, Ignacio Palacios Huerta, who's helped teams plan for penalties in Champions League finals and World Cup finals, says Villarreal's chances went up from 40 to 60% as a result. It seems mad, that, Ben. I've never known anyone go second.
No, I can't say I've heard of that. I didn't realise that. I just thought, to be fair, I mean, I thought it was an unbelievable set of penalties. I'm a bit uncomfortable, I suppose, with having to go at De Gea for not the finest penalty. I mean, Raul Albiol, I thought that was superb. Just ice cool, just rolls it into the opposite corner. Obviously, De Gea went the wrong way. Emery then sort of stroking his chin. It was just brilliant, wasn't it? And Albiol throughout the whole game, I thought was great. I noticed after the first goal, he kind of just stood there awkwardly. It was like, it reminded me of when I was in school, like in a rugby ruck and didn't really want to be involved. And he was just sort of there, but he knew he had to join the party in the celebrations, but he wasn't really, he was a bit half-hearted. But then, and his penalty was kind of almost the same, you know, just rolled in really sort of low maintenance, really nicely done.
What did you make of the United lineup, Archie? It seemed very attacking. You know, Pogba, one of two of the sort of deeper midfielders. You got Greenwood out on the pitch, you know, with Rashford and Cavani as well.
It was weird in that lineup, the fact that he broke up the McFred partnership in the defensive midfield, it said, okay, he's going to go for it. And then you look at that first half and no surprise that Villarreal defended compactly, put men behind the ball, and wanted to wait for a chance on the counter, or indeed at set pieces, as they did. But where were United? Where was the urgency that there should be? And I have to say, as somebody who watches a lot of German football and whatnot, I was just surprised at how much of a lack of a plan I thought was identifiable with United, because whenever they got the ball, they didn't seem to know what they were going to do next with it. And I've watched a lot of sides this season with much fewer resources than the Manchester United, who at least know, okay, when we get the ball, we're going to do this, even if it's against a deep-lying side that they had to face. It's an easier thing to play, but it's difficult to have the concentration to play the way that Villarreal did. And yeah, I think that this throws up question marks over Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I don't think that it's going to be seen that way at the club. And what's wrong with Manchester United is much bigger than Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. But they have to be very careful that they don't misread this season as we got close, because I don't think that they got close to what they really want this season.
Jonathan Wilson has come on this pod and repeatedly pointed out that United have an over-reliance on counter-attacking football, that they have an inability to beat teams who defend deep against them, and an over-reliance on big players delivering big moments. And that he has got pelters for saying this, and people have accused him of having an anti-Solskjaer agenda. But last night was yet another game that proved he is absolutely spot on. And if Wilson can spot it, then surely Unai Emery can spot it and other coaches can spot it. And that Villarreal got their tactics spot on. Now, before Ollie fans get cross with me, you could argue with some justification that he's gone from losing semi-finals to a final. He's gone from finishing sixth to finishing third to finishing second. So there is evidence of progress. But I don't think fans of other big teams would be worried about a Manchester United with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in charge. And I think he will remain in charge, because I don't think Manchester United's owners care about winning trophies. They just care about qualifying for the Champions League and the money that brings in. Compare and contrast with Villarreal, who have a very small club from a small town. Sid did a brilliant origin story on them yesterday or the day before, and made the observation that you could fit the entire population of the town of Villarreal in Old Trafford and still have 25,000 empty seats. But their owners are very hands-on. They care deeply about the local community. They care deeply about their fans, their players, and they care about winning things and progressing. And I think that's your difference between the two clubs. You know, Manchester United fans can say, oh, well, we finished second, we got to the final. But they are Manchester United. They claim to be one of the biggest clubs in world football, and now they haven't won anything under Solskjaer. Still, that's a problem.
Baz, just speaking to United fans out here, I think one of the things to watch next season is what's going to happen with these protests, because they are not going away. That is, I think, we've very much the tip of the iceberg. As one fan put it to me, that the stuff against Liverpool was just the start in terms of what they are prepared to do. And I think that with that background, it's really a question of where is this going to go next season, and how long are the owners going to hold out? We've seen it on smaller levels at Charlton and Blackpool in English football. But I think that we will actually see enough fan power that will eventually force them out. I know that they do not want to let go, but I honestly think that there is such a committed core at Manchester United that maybe the owners don't reckon with. But that is the first thing that's the first step that has to happen. I don't think it's... I think Solskjaer is a problem, as you say. But in the grand scheme of things, I think there are bigger things there. Not to say that Solskjaer doesn't have the support of the dressing room, by the way. When I spoke to Marcus Rashford, he sounded more like the manager than Ole Gunnar Solskjaer did last night. He was the one who was really fronting up for this. And I was
He runs the country, Archie, so he might as well be United manager.
I was just like, this is a bit strange, but there we go.
But I mean, the interesting thing about that is there will be Man United fans who protest regardless of how much success they have. But if they start winning things, then the number of people who are so focused on a protest, it will wane, because there are people on the out, you know, there is the hardcore, and that's not to sort of put down what they're protesting about or how important it is. That's the nature of football, right? If you start, if any of those clubs, the people who are complaining about Daniel Levy or the people who complain about Kroenke, if any of those clubs start winning things regularly, the number of people who are hell-bent on perhaps doing the right thing will just ebb away.
Don't worry, Max. If you look at the teams at the top of English football and what they're doing and the way that the just reactive fashion that Manchester United act in the transfer market, there's no danger of them winning things on a regular basis. I think even if they were to go out and get the three players that I've heard them linked with this summer in terms of a striker, a wide player and a defender, it reminds me of when everybody used to talk about Arsenal being one player away from a Premier League title, and then they could. It's like, I just, it's so much more than that, and yeah, there's a lot to be done there. There's just one anecdote I wanted to tell you from pitch side, which I thought you might enjoy, which was like with minutes to play. Man United had a throw-in, or Villarreal had a throw-in right next to the touchline, and one of the most vocal presences on the touchline is Lee Grant, who is like United's third choice goalkeeper, and he was like absolutely shouting for Marcus Rashford. He's like, "Rashi, Rashi, Rashi," and like eventually Rashford looks over at him, and he just points at Juan Foyt, who is like panting and breathing out his arse, and he just goes, "Look at him, mate. Fucked." and Foyt just starts laughing and is like, "Yeah, come on. And then 15 seconds later, Unai Emery is like, "Right, off you come." And he subs out Juan Foyt. So I was just like, it's just weird to see that. I mean, you don't hear what players say generally anymore, but it's just nice to kind of see that Sunday league element is still even there in like a European final.
Sure. And actually, on Juan Foyt, I mean, he did look like, you know, Blackadder by the end, didn't he? With like, you know, the pencils out of his nose and the bandage just sort of saying wibble. You know, Juan Foyt and Etienne Capoue, now the 88th and 89th players to leave Spurs and win a trophy in recent history. It's an interesting point, Anne-Marie, on mentioned Rashford there and Greenwood, who I thought had a better game than Rashford. But almost by playing in a football match, if you don't have a brilliant game, and we'll talk about the squad in part two, people are like, well, this isn't going to do, you know, will they make the cut now for the Euros? Basically, the best plan you have is to never play a football match and you just get better and better and better. You know, Harry Maguire got better because he wasn't there yesterday. And I feel like we're very reactive, aren't we? I'm very quick to judge all these things. You can have one slightly off day. It doesn't mean you're not a brilliant footballer.
Yeah, I don't know. I just wonder with the case, though, with Marcus Rashford, has this been an off day for a long period of time? It just hasn't been quite the same this season. And I know he's been injured and there's been, stuff around that. But I don't know. The game, he kept drifting out of position. But then you've got to give credit to Villarreal. They pretty much snuffed him out and Fernandes out as well yesterday. And sadly, as you've probably seen this morning, he's had a whole load of abusive messages online, over 70 messages to him last night, and he's put out a tweet about it. So, you know, I like Marcus Rashford. I think he's an automatic for the England squad, of course, but I don't think, you know, we're not going to judge him on just that one game yesterday.
He said, yeah, at least 70 racial slurs on my social accounts counted so far. For those working to make me feel any worse than I already do, good luck trying. I'm more outraged that one of the abusers that left a mountain of monkey emojis in my DMs is a maths teacher with an open profile. He teaches children. He can freely racially abuse without consequence. I mean, we've talked about this before, and I just cannot work out. At the moment, social media companies don't care, and racists know that they can racially abuse people and get away with it. And, you know, the four-day boycott, did it do anything? It was a good thing to do. Do we need a one-month boycott? Do we just need to all leave it? And, you know, at the same time, is this... I was listening to Liam Rossini on the radio this morning saying, look, social media racism is obviously a massive problem, but there are bigger societal problems about, you know, getting judged on your name, on a CV and your job interviews and... you know, positions of authority within politics, the judiciary, the media, et cetera, that we should perhaps be focusing on. And this is important, but a sideshow to that. It is not something we're going to solve in the next 3 minutes. And that is very frustrating. We need to talk about it more, but I don't know if talking about it, I don't know, Anne-Marie, if highlighting, as Marcus has done there, and, you know, it's different players make different choices, is the right thing to do now, because it just enables more people to racially abuse them, because there's no comeback. Until the social media companies take it seriously, there's just no comeback.
You know what, Max? You know what makes it really sad for me is that I expected this anyway.
Sure.
Expected it. What else can I say? You know, it's part of the course now. You expect him to get a whole load of messages, and that makes me incredibly sad.
Back to the game. Spanish Burnley was trending on Twitter in the second half. Ben, that seems slight. I mean, I quite like Burnley, so I don't find it massively offensive, but seems slightly harsh at the same time.
I quite like that, because I nominated Sean Dyche for sort of manager of the season when we did our annual sort of awards, as it were, along with David Moyes, I should say. But I mean, Burnley, I think, do amazing every season. They barely spend any money. Obviously, Villarreal, you know, a bit slightly different, I think. But I suppose when I could see them, there was a moment in the game where they had sort of a bank of seven or eight defenders. It just looked wonderfully organised, and I can see the sort of shades of Burnley in that. But I suppose in terms of comparing the two, I think it's nice, but I think Burnley, really, to be in the top flight is probably more surprising. I don't know than Villarreal. I don't know enough about Villarreal's sort of background, really. But I think Burnley in the top flight is still a marvel, really. I think people forget, a little bit like when Bournemouth came up. I know they spent money. But these teams that get to the Premier League, when you stay there for a few years, it kind of just gets lost. A bit like, I don't know, it just doesn't become new anymore. So, credit to Burnley, credit to Villarreal.
Jack says, why does the BT Sport punditry look like an awkward wake where no one really knew the deceased well? That's a great line. It's funny when they decide to make pundits all stand up. I actually got enraged in the first half about the criticism of Lindelof for the goal because it wasn't his man. You know, Moreno came from Luke Shaw and everyone just criticised Lindelof. And I got, it was like no one on social media had ever defended a free kick before. And actually, I thought BT analysed that pretty well at halftime. But Barry, you thought they were perhaps slightly jingoistic. Or actually, not just BT, just across all of British.
Yeah, not just BT. I thought just general coverage yesterday. It was as if Manchester United only had to turn up and collect the trophy. I thought it was quite disrespectful of Villarreal. I quite fancied Villarreal to win the game, to be honest. Obviously, it could have gone either way. I mean, it doesn't really matter, but I thought it was odd that maybe BT didn't have someone fighting Villarreal's corner in the studio, for example. It was a very Manchester United-centric and Ollie's mates-centric panel, but again, it doesn't matter.
I wouldn't really call them Ole's mates, Baz, if you listen to what they were saying after the game. Paul Scholes was very much going in on Ole and saying that he was as culpable there. So, yeah.
Should say McTominay had a great game and Edinson Cavani has good movement and Ole should have made some substitutes probably a bit earlier, and we forgot to say those things. And we've said them now. While we've got you, Archie, Ibrahima Konate, Leipzig to Liverpool, what are they getting?
A very good centre-back. One which is perhaps even better than Deo Upamecano going to Bayern Munich, if you trust the opinion, for example, of Sandro Wagner. He's been out, injured for parts of this season. But it's a solid move, and I wonder how Leipzig are going to fill all these voids at centre back that they now have.
Thank you, Archie. You may go back to bed.
Thank you.
That's where you were when this pod was due to start, and enjoy your.
Are you having a go?
No, I'm not having a go. we agreed a time, and Marie turned up on time. Ben turned up on time. Barry turned up on time. I turned up on time. But I'm not having, you know, it's okay. You had a late night. So yes, I am having a go, actually. I am having a go, but not in a rude way.
This is the most Rushton way of having a go.
And that'll do for part one, by the way. Archie's gone. We'll do the England squad in just a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly, June the 10th, the day before the Euros, a live show. You can get tickets from theguardian.com/guardianlive. Me, Lars, Wilson, Barry. Barry, it's going to be an evening to remember, isn't it? Although I can't remember a lot about the last one we did.
That's probably because you drank too much, Max. I remember it. It was very entertaining, a lot of fun. And yes, I hope everyone who's listening buys the ticket and tunes in. Well, just buys the ticket. After that, do what you like.
And there are still about 6 billion tickets remaining, I think, since everyone on Earth can buy one if they want. Now, that is the day before the Euros, and England are in the Euros, almost certain to win the whole thing. And Gareth Southgate has named a 33-man provisional squad ahead of cutting that down to 26 next Tuesday. Ben White and Ben Godfrey are in there, uncapped. No place for Patrick Bamford or James Maddison. Eric Dyer, Harry Winks, James Tarkowski have all played recently for Southgate. None of them are in. Other possibilities, Ezri Konsa, Fikayo Tomori, Lewis Dunk. And Marie, I mean, if he's naming 33, it's quite hard for there to be huge surprises, isn't there?
Yeah, very much so. And this is why Gareth Southgate gets paid the big bucks, because he's going to have to make some really difficult decisions in the next few days. I'm struggling myself to pick who the final seven is going to be that's not going to make the cut. The one I'm definitely... will not go, will be Aaron Ramsdale. That's as far as I get it, because when I then go down the list, I think, actually, no, he could go because he could do this, and he could go because he could do that. So good luck, Gareth, because you're going to need it.
So you've named a 32-man squad, Anne-Marie.
Yes,
quite
I
successfully.
Have.
Barry, have you got it down any further than that?
No. One of Aaron Ramsdale, Sam Johnson, definitely won't go. Ben White and Ben Godfrey probably won't go. Whoever Gareth Southgate drops, there will be a couple of controversial decisions which people will get outraged about and then quickly forget as soon as the tournament started. The last time an England manager picked a provisional squad for the Euros was Roy Hodgson in 2016. He picked a 26-man squad, and the three players who missed out were Fabian Delph, Andros Townsend and Danny Drinkwater. You'd imagine they were gutted. 2 weeks later, they were probably absolutely delighted because their reputations were untainted by association with the absolute shower that Roy Hodgson did choose to bring with him. So who's to say the same thing won't happen this time?
Ben, I do feel for Patrick Bamford because I sort of think he is in like for like if Harry Kane turns his ankle in a, you know, a warm-up game or the first game, that he's the most similar centre forward.
Yeah, he does a bit of everything. And clearly, I think it's 17 goals, you know, ahead of a record. People didn't think he would make the step up, has done so, you know, brilliantly. Can play other people in, obviously, which Harry Kane does so well. And I think that's interesting that up front, I mean, I even think Danny Ings possibly is a finisher, so clinical. I think you could make a case for him. I do like Mason Greenwood. And I think Watkins, in terms of work rate, brings a lot. So I can kind of understand maybe why Bamford has been left out, purely because I think he's got so many options up there. It's actually, defensively, I probably have a few more concerns. I do worry if Harry Maguire isn't fit or isn't fully fit, what we look like in the heart of defence.
I'm looking forward to some Leeds fans joining the dots of what you said and suggesting there that Patrick Bamford doesn't have good work rate and getting absolutely furious with you for the next few days. It's too late now, Ben. You've said it. I agree with you. Defensively, centre-back is, I guess, the most worrying position. Right-back isn't Anne-Marie, and I'm worried about how much we're going to have to talk about right-backs until he decides which of the four to let go. Since you can't drop anyone and you're taking them all with you, it's a really difficult decision, this, isn't it?
But isn't it a nice problem to have for once, that there's actually options and choice for Euro squad? And that's what's so good. And I think what's also good and what's also telling is that I think Southgate is thinking that he wants players that have versatility. He doesn't just want players who necessarily just play that one role, as we're now discovering with, for example, with somebody like Reece James. We know he can play out on the wing, but he can also play at the right back as well. So again, it's such a difficult choice. And I agree with Ben. I think defensively, I think that's where a lot of people are going to be looking at when the final cuts are made.
I think it's a terrible problem to have, because if one of them was injured, it would make your job so much easier. I think you could almost literally pick one out of a hat and say, right, he's not going. That may well end up what Gareth Southgate decides to do, but a very good right back is going to be left behind. And if England go out because of a mistake made by whoever is playing right back, Southgate will get slaughtered, because people will say, oh, well, Trent Alexander-Arnold wouldn't have done that. So
it's interesting. I actually asked Stuart Pearce this directly on Tuesday. He was in the radio studio when the squad was announced. And I said that, you know, when you were a manager, especially England under 21, and you had a difficult decision, were you hoping that someone got a calf strain? And he said, any manager who tells you that they've not secretly hoped that at one point is lying to you. So basically, Gareth Southgate, it would do him a favour if, you know, Reece James got an ingrowing toenail during the Champions League final, because then it's taken out of his hands.
I was just going to say, with Sancho, I think that's interesting, because he's got this profile, but I feel like the clamour for him is faded a little bit. And I wonder if he could be one of those that, you know, obviously seven are going to have to miss out. And I wonder if he might end up falling into that bracket, which I suppose this time last year would have been seen as quite a surprise. But I wonder if he may now be one that could be sort of droppable in that sense.
By all accounts, he has finished the season absolutely brilliantly for Dortmund. But I think you make a really interesting point in the way that we view international footballers, in that when someone is new and exciting, we really like them for a short amount of time, and then they're no longer new and exciting. So sort of the clamour for Grealish, because he was being so brilliant, is sort of lesser now. Like Lingard has been brilliant, right? He's on great form. He's in great shape. He's scored some beautiful goals. But because Jesse Lingard has played for England before for years, it's a less interesting or exciting pick than Saka or Bellingham or someone like that. And it doesn't mean that they shouldn't go. You know, clearly you want to pick players who are fit and on form. But I think Sancho, I think Sancho is the only one of the front three who naturally plays on the right. Sterling cuts in off the left. Foden has been playing off the left ahead of Sterling for City. Rashford cuts in on the left. I've forgotten the other 10. Greenwood, I guess, can play on the right, but you pick Sancho ahead of Greenwood. I don't know. Anyway, I've got so many good players. We're just going to win this. While we're on squads, Anne-Marie, the women's GB squad for the Olympics has been made. There's some surprises in there, are there?
Yeah, the one for me is the goalkeeper, Karen Bardsley, because she went out to OL Reign last season and has only made two appearances the entire season. So I'm really surprised by that. I would have thought that the coach might have just thought a little bit out of the box on that one. I'm not surprised that Steph Houghton's going to be going as captain. No Northern Irish players included in the squad. I think that might raise a couple of eyebrows considering they've qualified for the Euros in 2022. So yes, actually, there's some little bit of head scratching going on this morning.
I saw Northern Ireland play a friendly against England women, and I appreciate there's a huge gulf in class between the sides and that neither side had played for a very long time, but I thought they were absolutely dreadful. Like, awful. They got slaughtered. And I don't recall seeing anyone on that team who would go into an Olympic squad.
The reason why I say I'm a little bit surprised is it because they have qualified for Euro 2022. Okay, they were dreadful against England, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they would be dreadful against other teams that are playing in for the Olympics. So yeah, I would have expected it to be more outside the box thinking for Team GB. It's very England heavy.
Now, I'd like to talk about Hillsborough. Yesterday, two retired police officers and an ex-solicitor accused of altering police statements after the disaster were acquitted. Retired Chief Superintendent Donald Denton, retired Detective Chief Inspector Alan Foster and former solicitor Peter Metcalf had denied perverting the course of justice. The trial judge, Mr. Justice William Davis, ruled that the offence could not have been committed because the amendments were to prepare police statements for a public inquiry, which Davis described to the jury as an administrative exercise, not a course of public justice. So even if the amendments meant South Yorkshire Police withheld important evidence from the Taylor inquiry, that could not constitute perverting the course of justice. Margaret Aspinall, whose son James died in the disaster, said the ruling was an absolute mockery, the angriest she'd ever felt. We're always the losers, no matter what the outcome. What angers me, all the money it has cost the country, the taxpayers' money, for this to happen at the end, what a shambles, what a disgrace. Liverpool Football Club said the decision was a huge disappointment and that Hillsborough victims had been let down again. The Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham, who has campaigned with the Hillsborough family, said the ruling was a disgrace and so disrespectful to the families. I was chatting to David Conn yesterday. Look, he said this is the end of the legal fight. There are no avenues left. I'm not sure anyone can understand, Barry, why this case was brought. Why give the families any hope of justice? Why, you know, spend the money that is required where there couldn't be a verdict? And again, for the umpteenth time, those families who are now old, you know, some have passed away and they've fought so bravely for so long against authority, against the press, etc., etc. It just feels like another heartbreaking moment.
Yeah, I'm not a legal expert, obviously, but these guys seem to have got off on a technicality. And we're now in a situation where it has been ruled that the 96 at Hillsborough died unlawfully. But of the six men charged with offences relating to those unlawful deaths, only one has been found guilty of anything. That's Graham Mackerel, who was the then secretary of Sheffield Wednesday, and he was found guilty of a minor safety offence. So Margaret Aspinall described yesterday's decision as a cover-up of the cover-up of the cover-up. And it's hard to disagree, and it's hard to look at all this and say that it has been anything other than the establishment looking after its own. That's my inexpert view. But it seems to be a view that's widely shared.
All right, thanks, Barry. And that'll do for part two. We'll be back in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly manager news. Conte's left Inter just 3 weeks after winning their first Serie A title in 11 years. He met the club's directors before the last game against Udinese, was made aware of their plans. He wanted to spend more money. They don't want to spend any money. That's basically the problem. Zidane is leaving Real Madrid, according to Fabrizio Romano. Confirmed it. Another managerial news is that Pochettino is apparently in discussions with Spurs. Ben, how beautiful would that be? Or do you think you should never go back?
I quite like the idea of it, the notion of it. Whether it would actually work is another thing. I'd be surprised for Levy to go back. I just think, I don't know, it's sort of saving face and all that kind of thought. I just can't see him going down that route. Clearly, they need to do something. Quite a few people, it sounds like, have sort of politely declined and others have gone elsewhere. I never really understood whether it, how close or considered they were, but I never really understood the links with sort of Potter or Parker. That seemed the wrong move for Spurs. They clearly need someone with a bit of gravitas who's managed a club like Tottenham before. So Pochettino clearly fits that bracket. I just don't know if I can see it. I can't see Daniel Levy going there. I just can't see
it. He really has managed a team quite like Tottenham, hasn't he? You make a very good point. Do you reckon, Anne-Marie, he could persuade Harry Kane? I mean, I just can't see it happening at all, but it could be beautiful.
Could be, but I can't see it either, Max, to be honest. And I think whoever comes in, they've got a real job on their hands, because if it looks like Harry Kane is going to leave Tottenham, that's one issue. You've got the other issue, they're in this Europa League, Conference League, they're going to have to deal with that as well. Investment. I think if Pochettino was to come back, he'd have to be significantly backed, and I think that'll be his top priority. And I'm not sure Daniel Levy has the coffers to offer that at this time, given we're in, you know, still in a pandemic and fans are not back in the stadium. So yeah, like Ben says, I'm struggling actually to think of who could come in and manage Tottenham. There's not a long list of names.
Champions League final this weekend, Barry. It's Manchester City v Chelsea, Barry, just so you know. Are you looking forward to it, and what do you think will happen?
I am looking forward to it. I have no idea what will happen. My gut feeling is that Manchester City will probably win. I think they are the better team, but I would not be even remotely surprised if Chelsea prevailed.
There are some lovely stories in the papers. Jacob's done a piece about the journey of Edouard Mendy, 2014 released by third tier Cherbourg. In 2015, he was on the dole. He was about to take a job at a clothes shop, got a trial at Marseille and kicked on from there. I was reading about Marcus Alonso, whose dad and granddad both played in the European Cup final as well. So it's quite the heritage that Alonso has. Is the win more important for Tuchel or Guardiola, Ben?
I think more important, that's a good question. I think Guardiola, because I think this is the one City want. I know Guardiola publicly said the Premier League is still the ultimate prize, the one that gets everybody really excited. But I think City, whether Guardiola personally, maybe not because he's been there before, but I think for City as a club, for the model, for the investment, for the signings they've made over the years, I think the Champions League is the one that they all want and kind of need to a certain degree, to a probably quite a strong degree. For Chelsea, I think it's a bonus. I mean, considering where they were when Tuchel came in, to get into the top four, luckily or not, they're there. And if they could do this, I mean, it'd be hell of an achievement for Tuchel, but I think City need it more.
I think this will be Timo Werner's night. But I've said that about ahead of every Chelsea game, Anne-Marie. Who do you envisage being the hero of this game?
I think it's going to be Gundogan for City. I think he's going to pop up a couple of times with a couple of goals. I think it's also going to come down to, Max, which defence will deal with the attacks. I think that it's such a fine line between these two teams. I think it's going to be that thing. Defence and attack. Who's going to come out on top of that?
All right. Well, I'll be at the theatre, as we established, watching the Tony Blair rock opera. But, you know, I'll watch it on... I'll turn my phone off. I won't know. Playoffs, Ben. Brentford-Swansea. It's the most important game in the history of football every year, isn't it? It's the richest game in the world. Brentford, after heartbreak last year, do you see them getting over the line this time?
Yeah, it goes up a few quid every year, I think. That seems to be the way. That's where my heart will be on Saturday, I think, away from the Champions League. Not with Brentford, I should say, with the game. But yeah, Brentford looking for 10th time lucky in the playoffs. I believe they've got sort of the worst record in the playoffs, which is quite impressive in itself. And it's a weird one because even though Swansea were in the Premier League fairly recently, I think 3 years ago, the pressure is probably more on Brentford, or that nagging sense of pressure or sort of within in-house, if you like, at Brentford is probably there more for them than it is for Swansea. For Swansea, again, I think this is extraordinary achievement by Steve Cooper to get Swansea to this position. Last year they went close, lost to Brentford in the semi-final playoffs. And to be there again is amazing, really. I was looking at the numbers and they've spent something like £2 million since Cooper's been there on players, on first team players. And, you know, that is paltry, really. Even Brentford, who have a great model, I think I've spoken about it on here before, in terms of their recruitment, and rightly, I've lauded them and they are, you know, lauded for that. They have spent some money. Obviously, Ivan Toney, £6 million rising to 10 to replace Ollie Watkins. And I suppose for them, there's a little whiff of expectation, which is feels quite strange to say about Brentford. And on the day, I don't know. Swansea are very pragmatic under Cooper. This is not the Swansea of sort of Brendan Rodgers, Laudrup, and the sort of fabled Swansea way. This is quite hard to beat, gritty, occasionally quite grisly Swansea. And it'd be interesting to see how they cope with Brentford.
Is Leon Britton still centre mid?
Sadly not, but Alan Tait, who was a bit of a Swansea legend, and he was in the team when they got promoted in 2011 in the playoff final, is now first team coach to Steve Cooper, so he's still there. But yeah, Leon Britton is not at the club anymore.
Blackpool Lincoln, are Lincoln kind of, you know, this achievement, would that sort of match what Wickham managed last time?
Yeah, I think that's a good comparison, really, Max. Speaking to Michael Appleton this week, he was sort of suggesting, you know, this is way ahead of schedule for Lincoln. They're in non-league 4 years ago, which is bonkers, really. And they could do it. I think Blackpool will come into the game as favourites. They've blown away teams, blew away Oxford in the playoff semis. So, yeah, I think it's fair to say they'll be favourites. But Lincoln have a very young team. The squad profile is shifted drastically since Appleton's been there, from around 30 to 23. Again, it's a hell of a change, and quite a bold and brave change. One, I suppose it could have backfired, but it's paid off handsomely. And now they're one game from the Championship, which if they got there, I think, yeah, it's fair to say that would be sort of Wickham territory.
At Morecambe Newport, Newport had that amazing game against Forest Green. Kevin Ellison, 42, now facing his former club. It's a great story.
Yeah, I think that was probably game of the season, I think, Max. Unbelievable game. And yeah, Kevin Ellison certainly keen to get one over on his old manager, Derek Adams, who saw him kind of rot away, really, at Morecambe. He'd been at Morecambe, I think, 9 years, obviously long servant to the club, and was told by Derek Adams that he was no longer required. Believe Kevin was training with the reserves for the end of his time there and wasn't having a great time. Then it came to last summer. He was considering very close to taking a 9-5 job. Thought that was maybe it in football. And then it just had to happen, didn't it? He scored it wasn't just like a tap-in either. It was a 25-yarder to give Newport a chance to wrestle the tie against Forest Green. And now he gets the chance to get one over on his old manager at Wembley. I know it's cliche, but I don't think you could write the script.
It's worth saying congratulations to Sutton United, who won the National League. We didn't mention that on the Monday's pod. Ben is a Sutton fan. He says, is it time for the EFL to allow teams to have 3-4G pitches? If they're serious about making clubs sustainable, it can be a much needed income as the pitch can be rented throughout the year to the wider community. What are our views on allowing a 4G in the Football League? Actually, I think it makes quite a sensible point.
Well, I have a vague recollection, Max, of us interviewing the Harrogate chairman when they got promoted. And he said that it was going to cost them money, promotion, because it meant they had to get rid of their 4G pitch. which was a massive source of income from renting it out to various people who wanted to play on it. I don't know, I haven't played football for many years, and I don't know what the difference is between 4G and grass, or how big a difference. Maybe you could tell me.
It's worse on my knees. I mean, I'm not sure that's an issue for professional footballers. I don't know. As a purist, it feels like it needs to be grass. But I think I probably am just being a bit of a dinosaur there.
Ah, you joke, but I think in terms of that, the pitch, there's lots of managers, isn't there? Maybe, albeit much higher up the chain in sort of elite players. But I don't think they'd be too happy playing on a 3G pitch. And I think there's so many different hoops. I know even for Lincoln, for example, to if they were to get promoted, they have to upgrade this, upgrade that, floodlights. And it's the same, obviously, in the lower leagues. And I suppose, really, it's there. It's been that way for a long time. I think every club knows that's the drill. But like what Barry said, I think when Wealdstone got promoted to the National League, it was kind of because they had no fans for this season, or season just gone, if you like, it wasn't beneficial to them. It should have been their sort of greatest day or greatest season, but it's been quite miserable, really, in terms of the financial hardship that's come along as part of that package.
Jonty says, what are Ben Fisher's favourite EFL car parks? Portsmouth has a nice gravel effect, while Peterborough's is close to the entrance, but has poor phone signal.
Firstly, superb question. I think a bit of recency bias, but Swansea and Bournemouth would be up there, I think, for ease of access. Although Wembley this weekend is going to be a big test, so maybe, you know, there could be a lot to share after this weekend. Who knows?
Driving to Wembley?
Yeah.
Well, that is your first mistake, isn't it?
Exactly. Maybe it's an own goal before I've even left.
I mean, I don't know, Anne-Marie, how many games you've been to recently. I don't know if you have anything to... I can't really contribute to the car parking situation. Colchester's very accessible.
It is, yeah. Colchester is very accessible. I would even say when I've gone to see Arsenal women at Boreham Wood, it's also the car park is literally next door to the stadium. It's literally 30-second walk to the stadium. So, yeah, I had a little bit of trouble with it, actually, was Southampton. I went to see an England game at Southampton a couple of years ago, and I couldn't park in the car park at St Mary's, and I had to park in the town centre. And the press conferences had finished. Everyone had pretty much left the building, and I'm walking back on my own back to the city centre, and it wasn't pleasant, put it that way, at that time of night. So I'm always slightly conscious now that if I'm going to be doing a game, make sure I can get parking that is close by, so I'm not having to feel a little bit unnerved when I'm trying to walk to my car.
That's fair. Did you have any defence of the Southampton of St Mary's car parking situation, Ben?
It's a bit awkward because I feel like we've got on quite well with it. So, you know, this just goes to show it's a real can of worms, isn't it?
It's a minefield. Michael says, since Ian and Phoebe only gave you one day's notice, I'd like to formally invite Barry and six of his closest co-host friends to Mike and Kirsten's wedding in Jersey City, New Jersey, on the 1st of October, 2022. Should be plenty of time for him to find a suit and get his affairs in order. P.S. Where is Ellis? Ellis, very much part of our Euros coverage, we hope. Barry, will you go to, I presume, Michael, who sent the email, is Mike of Mike and Kirsten. He's not just inviting you to a random wedding. What do you think?
I'll be honest, Max. Even though I did complain at great length about not being invited to your wedding, I generally don't really like going to weddings anymore, particularly weddings where I'm not going to know anybody. But if I'm allowed to bring five friends, I probably won't. And I'll tell you, I was at a funeral recently and I put on my suit for the first time in, I would say, 2.5 years.
Yes.
Oh no. I think the dry cleaner shrank it.
Did you have to safety pin at the top?
No, but I had to do a lot of sucking in of my stomach. So yeah, that was quite worrying. It used to fit very well tailored suit, but not anymore. But just mentioning Ellis, I think it would be remiss of us not to point out that he's made a 4-part documentary about the history of Welsh football, which started on Monday, available to UK audience on the iPlayer, and I've seen the first episode, and it's really, really good, as you would expect from Ellis.
And of course,
he's got some top-notch guests on. So It's called Ellis James Football Nation.
And you know, because of how much, I mean, how much he loves Wales as a football team and a country, he wouldn't mind if nobody watched it. It's the fact that he got to stand near Ian Rush, yeah. You know, there'll be just times when he's just staring at, you know, I've seen him when he's like, you know, just anytime he sees like Cliff Jones doing anything, he's like, I can't believe I'm this close to this sort of legend. His love of the game is a beautiful thing.
Well, anytime him and his cameraman were off filming something, they'd always bring a ball with them, so because they did a lot of filming at various grounds. So when he finished interviewing Rushy, he asked, you know, oh, do you fancy a kickabout? And Rushy was up for it. So, that would have just made his life.
I played up front with Ian Rush at Old Trafford once. I said just before we went out for the second half, I said, listen, you play on the last man and I'll just play in the hole. And he looked at me and went, oh, shut up. We went out. We had a nice time. That'll do for today. Thank you so much for your time, Ben.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anne-Marie.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back, looking back at the playoff finals and the Champions League final on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.